Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Legislators are back on the job in Washington after the holiday recess. We'll check in with St. Louis Public Radio's man in Washington, Jim Howard, a little bit later in the program. But first, for 32 years, former Congressman Barney Frank represented parts of the Boston metropolitan area in Congress as an outspoken advocate for financial reform, civil rights, and gay rights. He was the first congressman to voluntarily come out of the closet. He tells that part of the story and much more in his new book, Frank, A Life in Politics. He was in St. Louis last Friday, and I had the pleasure of interviewing him before a full house audience of 550 people at the St. Louis County Library. He did not disappoint, showing both the candor and wit for which he has always been known. I began by asking about his famous use of humor with political friends and adversaries alike and asked how well it has served him over the years.
It's one of the great breaks I get. I have a good sense of humor. I appreciate that, and I'm not going to pretend that I don't know that. But I can say that with modesty because I had absolutely nothing to do with earning it. It was something I was born with. I was born with a terrible sense of direction. I am very clumsy. I have been in a lifelong war with inanimate objects, which I generally lose. I have had three significant relationships in my life, and I can, as different as all three of them were, I can hear in my head all three of them saying the same thing. Barney, don't touch it. I say, no, I'll break it. But I was born with the ability to make people laugh and also to enjoy humor. So it has first served me by keeping me sane and interested. If I couldn't fool around and if I couldn't see the funny side of things, the job would be a lot more tiresome. As I've said early on, I made a career choice between being a scholar and being a politician, in part because, and I mean this one seriously, though it's, I understand it has its humorous aspects, I hope, because of a deep-rooted personal characteristic, which was an advantage in the one and a disadvantage in the other, I have a very short attention span. Now, that's not good for writing a PhD thesis. It's essential if you're dealing with eight different issues in half a day. So humor helps keep me focused. Beyond that, though, it has two other advantages. First, you are competing for people's attention. There is a huge torrent of information pouring at people. You want them, A, to listen to you in the first place, and B, to remember. If you can say something funny, you are ahead on both counts. Humor is, they will remember it more. Secondly, people do not like to be ridiculed. And one of the things you want when you are in politics is a competition. And when you are competing, intimidating your opponents in a legitimate way is a useful thing to be able to do. And the fact that I would on some occasions be able successfully to ridicule people, one of the things that you want. Well, I'll give you an example. Other than that, there's a great book, Advising Consent, which I mentioned, about the United States Senate. And it mentions of the one character, Charles Lawton, if you saw the movie, that he was accused of, there was a rumor that he had once threatened another senator with a knife. And the book says it wasn't true, but he had no interest in refuting it. Because having other senators think he might stab them gave him a little edge in certain negotiations. Well, I didn't use a knife, but having people be reluctant to be ridiculed was very important. I did make a point of, and actually I was thinking of that when I heard about your book title, which I may have to go read.
Please do.
I almost never ridiculed people personally. It was to make fun of their ideas, which was, you know, inconsistencies and hypocrisies. On occasion, with regard to out-and-out bigots, I would do that. So your How to Be Rude?
How to Be Rude, politely available at all local bookstores.
Right, because I had been operating under a British variant of it, which was, a gentleman is never rude unintentionally. But being able to do both would be very helpful. I'm going to have to read that.
Who have you intimidated with your humor? Give me a good example, someone we'd all know.
Well, I will say Republicans in general. I was told recently by a guy I met who had worked on the staff of the Republicans on the Financial Services Committee, and he said, you know, we had this problem when you were leading the fight on your side of finding someone who would take the side against you. And again, it wasn't just losing the argument, but being ridiculed. So, and I'll give you one example where I think it was very effective. because I don't, I have nothing to lose in terms of our relationship. The former House Majority Leader, Dick Armey, who in 1995 was explaining why he wasn't going to write a book, because what had happened was Newt Gingrich, as Speaker, had been given $5 million by Fox for anticipatory royalties to write a book, or as we would technically call it, a bribe, because nobody thought he was going to sell enough books. So that became a big outcry about these politically motivated advances. So he was asked, Armey was asked, well, you're going to write a book. He said, nah, I don't. He was saying he didn't want to be criticized for it. And he then said, and he was caught on tape, fortunately, I don't need Barney Fagg yelling in my ear over a book. He then tried to claim that he hadn't said it, but they had it on tape. And I, you know, I couldn't let it go unanswered, but I did not want to act wounded and sort of perpetuate the overly emotional stereotype. So my brother, my younger brother, who's very smart, came up with the response, which we then asked our mother to say, which she agreed to be quoted as saying, because remember, his argument was that this was not a deliberate slur, it was a mispronunciation of the word Frank. And my mother said, you know, in the 59 years since I married my husband, no one ever introduced me as Elsie Fagg. And that had a lot of bite. Partly, as a student of humor, you understand, it's because her name was Elsie. Elsie is a funnier name than Mary. I mean, Elsie, it was Elsie the Borden Cow, and Elsie had that kind of... But I know that hurt Armey badly.
Yeah, I think most of us would agree that we don't find an awful lot of humor coming out of Washington these days. Do you?
Well, some of it is. Look, I think some of what Ted Cruz says, I'll be honest with you, is hilarious. I was on the Bill Maher show, and I learned that Ted Cruz actually said, when asked what his favorite music was, that he used to be a fan of classic rock, but he was so disappointed at the rock industry's reaction to 9/11 that he switched to country as his favorite. Now, I mean, he violated a fundamental rule that I have tried to urge on other politicians. No matter how much you think it might help you, try not to say something that literally no one will believe. That is rarely going to help you. But actually, Bill Maher then played about 11 albums and concerts that the classic rock people had done. But that was pretty funny.
You know, much is made, obviously, of the polarization in the Capitol these days and in many states, and including our own, quite frankly. But one of the things you point out in your book that surprised me, because we're hearing so much today about the good old days when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill would sit down and have a drink and solve all the problems that were before them. We've been hearing that a lot, right?
Yes.
In your book, you point out they didn't get along all that well.
They got along on policy, and that was important. I mean, they used to say, oh, Tip O'Neill and Reagan are friends after 5 o'clock, you know, when the workday ended. Yeah. Actually, if you knew Reagan, that was about 12:30. He was not going to 5 o'clock. But, well, Tip O'Neill felt the need to cooperate with him. He resented him, and it's part of the theme I've carried out. He was particularly resentful because he said, you know, this guy was a poor Irish kid like I was. You know, not in poverty, but in a working-class Irish situation. And he got rich, and he forgot that there were still poor people and became part of the elite. And O'Neill was very unhappy, very angry that Reagan was one of those people who he thought, yeah, I made it, and I leave everybody else behind. He also had very little regard for his intellectual command of policy. Every politician had to admire Reagan's political skills. He was very good at that. But they would come back and report that he would be reading from note cards at meetings. And I remember, actually, it wasn't O'Neill, it was former Speaker Tom Foley, who said that they went to one policy meeting and Reagan was reading from the wrong note cards and did not seem to notice it.
And, of course, there was always Nancy nearby to whisper
But they did cooperate on policy. I mean, in 1983, they cooperated in terms of, for the first time, taxing Social Security. And that was very important because it was the deterioration in American politics, the anger, the excessive partisanship came in two stages. And it first came from Newt Gingrich. And Newt Gingrich, in the late 80s and early 90s, explicitly said, we cannot treat the Democrats as reasonable people with whom we disagree. They are the enemy. He actually organized and forced out the then minority leader, Bob Michael from Illinois, because he said he was too friendly with the Democrats. So he began this this, and then we responded in kind. The Tea Party then came and took it an order of magnitude worse. But so Reagan and O'Neill did cooperate on policy, but there was no great personal love.
You told an interesting story in the book. You wrestled for a good many years about coming out.
Yes.
That's well documented in the book, and I think most people know that story. But the funny part about the Tip O'Neill aspect of this is when you went to him, you tell the story, when you went to him and say, Tip, I'm gay.
It was a bad moment. We were sitting on the floor debating, and we were losing at that time the effort to restrict funds going to the Nicaraguan Contras. And O'Neill was misunderstood. He was this big caricature of a politician, you know, a big overweight guy with a, as he described, big red nose, floppy ears, you know, all white hair, and he was the, hi, how are you, darling, was his, darling, by the way, is darling in Massachusetts. And but he was very smart. He didn't want people quite to know how smart he was, and he was also, for a guy rooted in the old ways, he was adapting to new ways. Too often someone who was very skilled and successful in the existing set of arrangements, almost instinctively doesn't like change because how does he know how well he's going to do? And that included his attitude on LGBT rights. In 1979, very early in this business, I was still in the state legislature, and there was a gay march on Washington. And I lived in O'Neill's district at the time. I actually moved to run for Congress. And I rounded up. I was the leader in the state legislature on LGBT rights. I wasn't out myself, but I was obviously friendly with the leaders. So I rounded up every Irish gay man and lesbian I could find in Massachusetts and told them to get dressed, suits and dresses, suits for the men, dresses for the women. One of the points I made, you know, whatever you want to do as your personal expression is fine, but we need to learn this more, and we did from the African-American movement. When you're trying to persuade people on important issues, don't pick fights on unimportant issues. Be acquiescent on everything but the issues you're trying to focus on. So we brought him to see O'Neill, and he said, you know what all the homosexuals ought to do? You ought to tell everybody you're a homosexual because they say you're going to be blackmailed. But if everybody knew who you were, you couldn't be blackmailed, which was people went out and said, my God, Speaker of the House just told me to come out. I mean, that was a big deal. But anyway, I approached him in 86 because a book was about to come out that hinted that I was gay. And I was thinking about telling people, but that book was, it was kind of a seamy book from a seamy guy. And I didn't want it then, but I had to be prepared for it. So I approached him on the floor, and I said, Tip, a book's about to come out that's going to say that I'm gay. And he said, oh, man, you don't be paying any attention to that bleep. You know, they're always spreading that stuff about us. I said, well, in this case, though, it's true. It's not. Oh, he said, oh, Bonnie, I'm so sad. And he was very, but he was sad because of my career. He was not personally offended. In fact, he said that I might have had some leadership potential. It was very flattering. A couple of minutes later, I ran into a great liberal leader, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder, and she saw me and said, oh, thank God, you're okay. I said, what made you think I wasn't? She said, I just ran into Tip. And he said, oh, Pat, have you heard the news about Bonnie? Isn't it awful? And but he then went on to say, and I got it wrong in the book, I acknowledge. I said it was Chris Matthews, who was then his press secretary. Instead, he told the journalist Mike Barnicle. They were talking, and he said, Mike, old pal, I'm afraid our friend Bonnie Frank is all through in politics. And Mike said, why? He said, well, I think he's going to come out of the room.
Why did it take you so long? You wrestled with this for a good many years before deciding to let the world know.
That's a very valid point. I realized I was a homosexual, as we then called it. At first, when I was 13, but by the time I was 14, I knew it. But I also knew at the time that everybody hated homosexuals, including ourselves. I say in the book, there was a time during the Army-McCarthy hearings when the leader of the anti-Joe McCarthy forces, Joe Welch, made a very effective point against McCarthy by invoking the homosexuality of his chief aide, Roy Cohn. And I cheered for that. I mean, he was this great liberal using any gay prejudice, and all the liberals thought that was wonderful, including me. So at first, I couldn't tell anybody because everybody hates us. And why would, by the way, for those who think it is a choice, yes, there's nothing a 14-year-old is likely to do than decide to become the most hated minority in the history of the world. But as it went on, I said, okay, I think I'm going to go into politics, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sacrifice my personal life. Because it was clear to me, this is now in the late 60s, I'm graduating from school and I'm going to work for the mayor of Boston. If anybody knew that I was gay, that would be the end of a political career. So I decided I had to choose between a personal life and a political life, and I chose the political life on the theory that I could just literally repress. I mean, I wasn't just closeted, I was repressing. I wasn't kidding myself, but I was very repressed. And then came Stonewall in 1969. Now, that was the riot by mostly drag queens against cops who were being abusive of them. There's really no important social movement in America that I can think of that has so clear-cut a starting date. So then people started saying, hey, you know, we're not taking this anymore. So by the early 70s, I began to think, well, yeah, maybe we have a case here. And I was thinking about that, and then I got a chance to run for the state legislature. Unexpectedly, a guy quit, and it was the only area in Boston, which I happen to live in, where I could have won a race. I'm Jewish, I talk funny, I'm from New Jersey. Boston is very provincial, but this was downtown Boston, Back Bay, Beacon Hill. It was populated by yuppies, so even that's free yuppie as a term, but I figured, okay, I can win that. But then I had to say, okay, if I tell people I'm gay, I'll never win. I'm going to try to win. So I made two decisions at that time. One, I will be a coward. I will not be honest and brave that prejudice personally. But two, I will never be a hypocrite. From the day I get elected, I will confront the anti-gay prejudice as a matter of public policy. So I filed the first gay rights bill in 1972. And I figured, okay, I'm going to have this career and I'll have no private life. And I know there are people who say, you know, if you have a good enough career, you don't need a private life. You'll get all the satisfaction from your career. Nonsense. In fact, it's the reverse. What I found was that as I became more prominent and was getting more praise and I was more highly regarded as a public official, the contrast between that and the utter bleakness of my private life was a great strain. So I then decided in the mid-70s, I'm going to come out. I figured I'll finish out a few more terms in the state legislature. I went to law school, so I'd have a way to make a living. I will then retire. I will have been one of the highest-ranking gay elected officials at the time in the Massachusetts legislature, and I'll be a gay activist, and I will be the advocate for gay rights while making a good living as a lawyer. And then divine intervention put an end to that. Specifically, and I know you have a number of good Jesuit universities in the area, I have a strong Jesuit connection. The man I replaced in Congress was a Jesuit priest named Robert Drynan. He was the dean of Boston College Law School and a leading liberal and anti-war activist. And when Pope John Paul II became the Pope, he was persuaded by American conservative Catholics to order Drynan not to run again. I had been living in Tip O'Neill's district, and it was obviously, I didn't want to, I couldn't. I mean, that closed off that avenue. But all of a sudden, there was now an open congressional seat in the district next to mine, which was probably the only other district in the state that I could win. And I had to live very close to it. So I moved in, and yes, that does mean that if it had not been for Pope John Paul II, I would never have been in Congress. But Drynan said he regretted that he was never allowed to get near the Pope after this, because he did want to say to him, you know that business with my seat in Congress, did that work out the way you expected it to? But at that point, I shut the closet door again, because I knew I couldn't go to Congress. So I go to Congress, and I think, okay, I can't live repressed. I have to have a life that gives me the emotional and physical outlets any human being wants. So here's what I'll do. I'll go to Washington. I'm away from home. There's a little more privacy there. I won't be out publicly, but I'll live as a gay man socializing with other gay people, you know, after work. That soon became clear it didn't work. Because as I became somewhat prominent as a member of Congress, the answer was, other people could do that. You could be closeted at work, you know, be out after work. But I needed not privacy, but secrecy, because I could be seen. Now, by the way, none of this would have been even remotely possible today in the age of the internet, the cell phone camera. I would have been nailed in about an hour. So, but you still had that little zone there. So what happened was I experimented with this, and by the mid-80s, I said, no, this isn't working. And at that point, I said, okay, I enjoy this career, and I think I'm good at it, but I can't stand this living anymore the way I am. And if I have to choose, the original choice was career over private life. After 12 or 13 years of that, I said, no, I have to have a private life. If it costs me my career, I'll regret it, but I have to do it. And fortunately, it didn't.
Welcome back as we continue our conversation with former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, recorded last Friday evening at the St. Louis County Library. I asked the congressman about his feeling that the American public seems to look more favorably upon the LGBT community than it does to the U.S. Congress.
Oh, I say, I started out feeling frustrated because I wanted very much to get into public life and change society. I wanted less economic unfairness. I wanted more freedom of personal action. I wanted to end discrimination. I wanted to hold down excessive military intervention. But I figured I could never do that, because the government, which was the platform from which you did all these important things in society, would exclude me because I was gay. As the time went on, it began to shift. And tolerance and acceptance, because tolerance is a lower level, but tolerance and then acceptance and then even approval of LGBT people's choices started to go up as support for government went down. And at some point, frankly, in the late 80s, early 90s, they passed each other. And by my last years in Congress, and this is literally true, my marriage to my husband, Jim — I'm the only member of Congress still who had a same-sex marriage. There were a couple other married people who were married before. But my marriage to Jim received a higher approval rating from the voters than my chairmanship of the Financial Services Committee. In fact, as I said to Chris Dodd, my collaborator, you know, I enjoyed working with you, but it turns out the public would rather have me hanging out with Jim than with you.
Well, you know, it looks like the Supreme Court is going to weigh in probably in just a few weeks on this issue of same-sex marriage. And I've read with some interest some of the things that you've been saying about Justice Scalia recently, most recently that he's a homophobe, to use your term. You know, I think most people would think this isn't going to help that cause very much.
Oh, he wouldn't vote for us under any circumstances. This is a bigot who exposes his bigotry, compares gay people to murder, explicitly says that society has its right to express its revulsion of us. And the key was this. There was a case out of Texas where two men were criminally prosecuted in Texas for having consenting sex in their own apartment, two adults. And the Supreme Court finally overturned that. And it was, I think there were only two dissenters. But the two dissenters were Justices Thomas and Scalia. And Justice Thomas, I don't agree with his view of the Constitution, but he had a reasonable statement. He said, look, I think this is an incredibly silly law. And if I was in a legislature, I would vote against it. But I do not see that the Constitution empowers me to knock it down. Scalia, on the other hand, wrote this diatribe about how terrible this was, that people who engaged in this kind of sex were basically bad people and damn well should be punished. So, there's nothing to be lost by characterizing him as a bigot, which he is. It troubles me a little bit. There's a play about him now, and he's a funny guy, and he's a great friend of Justice Ginsburg. I do believe that we have made more progress, unfortunately, in attitude about LGBT people than we have on the race question. That troubles me. But I do think this. If any Supreme Court justice expressed the virulent dislike of any major group — African Americans, Jews, women, Hispanics — that he expresses towards us, He would not be considered a respectable person.
Do you have any sense in your own mind as to which way the court's going to go on this?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty confident they're going to decide in favor of same-sex marriage. First of all, I ought to say, by the way, that among those rooting for them to find in favor of same-sex marriage as a universal constitutional right in America, and it goes to your point about the change in attitudes, I'm going to bet that nobody is more eager for that decision to come down than Karl Rove. Because the Republicans who have any kind of strategic electoral sense understand that this puts them in a bind, because their conservative base voters are against same-sex marriage. But the electorate as a whole thinks that that's a prejudiced position, kind of, you know, like we saw in a different issue, same general one in Indiana. So what the Republicans are hoping for is that the Supreme Court says, that's it. So a conservative comes to a Republican and says, get rid of same-sex marriage. And he says, sorry, I can't. The court has done it. And the reason I'm sure — there are two reasons I'm sure. First of all, I know the four liberals are ready to vote to uphold this. The worst we're going to get is 5-4. Probably it's going to be 5-4. I don't think you get another one. The key vote is Justice Kennedy. Now, Kennedy's been a conservative on things like Citizens United and other areas. But he has not only voted for LGBT legal equality, he has insisted on writing the opinion in every such case. He's gotten to be able to write the opinion, by the way, because opinions under the in the Supreme Court are assigned by the Chief Justice, if he's on the side that he's on, and if the Chief Justice is not on that side, by the Senior Justice on the other side. And since the Chief Justices have always been on the wrong side, from my standpoint, Kennedy has assigned himself this opinion. So he's already written three very strong pro-LGBT opinions, including in the sodomy case. Secondly, it's a simple matter of judicial common sense. After the court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act, by the way, sign of my frustration that we have not, frankly, done as well on the racial issue, the same week that the court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act and made me very happy, they threw out the Voting Rights Act and retarded our efforts to continue with racial fairness. But after that, several of the federal circuit courts said the gay people can get married no matter what the state law was. And I think at that point, the Supreme Court was ready to wait a year. But then one of the federal circuits went the other way. One of the federal circuits said, no, there's no such constitutional right. That meant the Supreme Court had to take the case. You cannot have a situation where in some states the federal ruling is one way and in other states it's another way, direct conflict. So the states which had been told they had to end their bans on same-sex marriage went to the Supreme Court and said, all right, look, we've been told we have to end the ban. Other people don't have to end the ban. You're going to decide it in June. You should stay that decision. Don't make us go through this now, and then we'll see what happens. Well, I think this is absolutely the case. If the Supreme Court thought there was any chance that they were going to overturn that decision and say, no, there was no such right in June, it would have been irresponsible to allow these states to perform all those marriages in the interim. And they said, no, these take effect. So I think that was their signal that it's going to be a 5-4 vote in favor of a federal constitutional right that they're same-sex marriage.
You talk about a greater acceptance in today's society. I'd like to get a quick reaction from you to the fact that President Obama just a couple of days ago called for an end to conversion therapies. Conversion therapies mean you can correct through therapy homosexuality.
Well, partly I'm all in favor of it with this qualification that it applies only to young people. If a 40-year-old lesbian wants to waste her money trying to not be a lesbian, good luck to her. I'm a libertarian. Frankly, I think if people want to smoke marijuana or sniff cocaine or ingest heroin, I think it's a bad idea. We should tell them it's a bad idea. But I believe that people should be able to make those choices. But it ought to be illegal for people to force their children to do it because it does enormous harm. And basically, it first says to the kid, you're a bad person. You're such a bad person. I got to spend all this money trying to totally change you. And I think what he did was perfectly right. But, over and above the LGBT issue, I think in the exercise of their power to regulate medical care so it's not fraudulent, states should do that. This notion that you can be talked out of being gay, I think, is preposterous. And the evidence is that occasionally some people under great pressure say that and slip back again. And, there is the view that going to a therapy session that cures you of being gay is a great way to meet guys. So I think what the president did was absolutely right and indicative of the, very few people are leaping to his defense. By the way, even more so with what's going on in Indiana. And I now believe that, again, race is a stubborn issue. I don't have to tell people in this area about that. But what's happened in Indiana and Arkansas makes me think we are close to the end of anti-gay prejudice as a significant factor. It's for this reason. Yes, we had those of us who believe morally that discrimination is wrong and there should be fairness against what they did in Indiana. But what sunk that law, what brought the roof in on that conservative governor and a culturally conservative...
That's the religious freedom law.
The religious freedom law. The business community stepped in and said, knock it off, you are getting in the way of our making money. And look... Let's be clear, morality is great, and it's an important way you win some votes. But in America, maybe in some other societies, when the business community says you are now interfering with the economic efficiency of the country, the fight's over. And I think you're going to see that, and that's basically what the business community is saying is, listen, do not give us the right to discriminate, because if we have the right to discriminate, we're in the middle. Either we discriminate against gay people and the right and the gay people boycott us, or we don't discriminate and the anti-gay people boycott us. Leave us alone. Leave us out of this. Let us just do business. And I think now that the profit motive has been enlisted on behalf of LGBT rights, the fight's about over. I would just say, talking about race, comparable question, and I have been discouraged about race. The question, though, is I now believe that that shooting of the murder of the black man in South Carolina by a cop is going to be a major turning point. I mean, the absolute presumption of accuracy that attached to every police officer's report has now clearly been seriously undermined. That doesn't mean they're all wrong, and it doesn't mean that they don't have a tough job and are entitled to defend themselves. But I think that tragedy is going to bring out, frankly, a significant improvement in that aspect of our society as well.
I'm glad you took it there, because that's where I wanted to go next. You know, a lot of people were saying the same thing with regard to what went on here in Ferguson last August, that this is going to change everything. And the next thing you know, it's happening again. You've worked in this field of civil rights and race relations for your entire career, even before you got into politics. I mean, how far have we actually come?
Well, we've come very, very far in this sense. 60 years ago, you were born black, you had very bleak prospects. No matter how hard you worked and how educated you were, we have substantially diminished the prejudice. And in fact, there is full legal equality, but the feeling is still there. But I think we have been making progress. There was a little bit of a, well, let's put it this way. The fact that there is this mistreatment, let me state it more neutrally, the fact that there is serious inequality in law enforcement, it hasn't gotten worse. Nothing new about that. This isn't worse than it was 40 years ago. It's probably better in a lot of ways. It's just that we have now reached a point in society where people can challenge it more effectively, and that's why I think South Carolina is going to bring it around. As far as Ferguson is concerned, maybe controversial here, those are much more ambiguous circumstances. Much more ambiguous circumstances. Staten Island was a case where...
Eric Garner.
Which was an easier case to make against those cops. But this one is so clear-cut and so graphic. By the way, another aside, I keep getting into these other sides, but I won't see you again. I got to unload everything.
Makes my job easier.
Some of my... I know there is this liberal unease about surveillance and cameras, but let's be very clear. If it were not for surveillance cameras, we would not have convicted the Marathon bomber, and we would not have had this irrefutable evidence that there is some police misconduct towards African-Americans. And somebody's pointed out the worst thing was that if it hadn't been the camera, those reports were dishonest and would have been accepted without challenge.
There are a couple of other things I'd like to touch upon. One of them is Dodd-Frank, bears your name, although you indicated in the book you don't much care for having your name attached to things.
I refer to it as a fans reform bill. One of the stupidest things a politician does is to refer to himself in the third person. In my lifetime, the only individual I saw who could refer to himself in the third person and not look like a pompous twit was General Charles de Gaulle, a grand figure. But anybody else who talks about himself as himself, he looks silly.
Well, Dodd-Frank seems to have a target on its back right now. What are chances of its survival?
Well, obviously a central question for me and framed exactly the right way. The president did sign a bill under some coercion that weakened a part of it. It was not a central part of it. The part had to do with where derivative transactions were conducted. The more important part are the rules that apply to derivative transactions wherever they're conducted. But what bothered me was the method of the Republicans putting that in another bill. What then happened was an outcry, that, including from some Democrats, that the president should not have signed the bill. And it came from Nancy Pelosi. It came from Elizabeth Warren. It came from a woman whom I don't know, if you understand, all of you know her St. Louis roots, but she's the woman who replaced me as the senior Democrat of the Financial Services Committee, Maxine Waters, who was a St. Louis girl, as she proudly says. And Hillary Clinton put out a tweet saying, no, we can't do this. So I am now convinced any effort to weaken it between now and 2017 will fail. The president will veto it, and he'll be backed up. And if the Republicans try to make that a public issue, they'll lose. But the question now is, it is at risk because of the 2016 election. The 2016 election for president and Congress, but especially president, is going to decide, for example, whether the Citizens United decision allowing money from corporations stands or falls. I believe if a Democrat is elected president, you will see that reversed by the Supreme Court. whether or not we do anything about climate change, that will clearly be on the ballot, and whether or not we continue financial reform, because the Republicans are all committed to undoing it. So the answer is, it is fine now. If a Republican wins, I think we lose it. On the other hand, if a Democrat wins in 2016, by 2020, it will be too late to repeal it. It will be baked into the cake, as the economists say. So I believe financial reform is working well. It is going to be unchanged. It won't be weakened before the end of 2016, but its future depends on the presidential election.
Okay, you mentioned the presidential election. I guess we do have one coming up, don't we? You've also mentioned two ladies figuring prominently in the discussion. It appears that Hillary Clinton is going to announce her candidacy this weekend, Sunday. Thoughts about that candidacy? And you also mentioned Elizabeth Warren, whom a lot of people would like to see perhaps there instead of Mrs. Clinton. And you've worked closely with her.
I did. Yeah. I admire both of them enormously. I think they both have important roles to play, which is Hillary Clinton for president and Senator Warren staying in the Senate for a couple of reasons. First of all, I understand a lot of my friends on the left feel dissatisfied with Hillary Clinton. I do not think there was reason for that. I'd urge people, go back and read the columns of Paul Krugman in 2008. Krugman, the great economist who has a wonderful facility for taking sophisticated economics and putting in terms of real issues. He's the New York Times columnist twice a week. He showed during the 2008 election that Hillary Clinton was to the left of Barack Obama on domestic issues. She was too hawkish on foreign policy. Unfortunately, he became a little that way. My biggest issue from now on is to get everybody, Democrats and Republicans, to cut back on this worldwide military interventionism, which does more harm than good and is enormously expensive. But this notion of Hillary Clinton as being too conservative is a great mistake. I don't think there are too many issues where she and Senator Warren differ, at least in terms of what's achievable. I admire Elizabeth Warren enormously. If you look at the back of my book, she's one of the people I asked for a blurb, and I'm very proud that she did it. I heard her on Conan O'Brien the other night talking about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which she had come up with, and as she says in her book, it was our collaboration that brought it about. If she were to announce today that she was running for president, the focus on her would shift from being a staunch defender of financial reform and fairness for the middle class to, why did she say that? She's running for this. She's running for that. Her effectiveness as a clear defender of these values would be diminished. And then the argument, I've heard some people say, frankly, I just think it's not sensible. Well, the Democrats need a good primary fight. There's nothing like a good primary fight. Well, anytime I hear people talk about how wonderful a primary fight is, I know they've never been in one. They're a pain in the ass. But I have to say, to my liberal friends who want there to be a nice, divisive Democratic Party debate over issues, where were they in 2012? Did they really think that was good for Mitt Romney? Do we really want to reproduce what happened on that side? You know, plus, look, the poll show, Hillary Clinton is very popular. There are some issues where Elizabeth Warren is to Hillary Clinton's left. Not a whole lot. Probably on foreign policy. I agree with Senator Warren there, and I wish the whole country did. But at this point, I do not think you could go much further to the left, and Hillary Clinton is pretty good, but anyway, and win the election. So I hope she wins. I do not encourage people to run against her. Last point, money. At this point, the Republicans have an awful lot of money. I'd like to save all of our money and not waste it on each other so we can use it for the final election.
Former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank in an interview recorded Friday at the St. Louis County Library about his brand-new book, Frank. Coming up, a few minutes with Jim Howard, St. Louis Public Radio's Man in Washington. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.